Somehow to get an old man like that to help me get out of a chair. That's pretty bad. I'm Tom Ivester, an alcoholic. Member of the primary purpose group in Southern Pines, North Carolina. And I'm a full-blooded member there. That's where I belong. And that's where, if there's a problem, it's mine. Yeah, that's what a home group's about. So I'm delighted and great to be here. Good. It's a preview for what's coming up in 15, eh? You're getting a little warm up. We almost got enough people here to put on the international. At least the ticket sales, maybe. But that's going to be a great, great challenge. And I know you guys will really respond to that. Now it'll come through. And it'll be the first one that's even halfway close to me. So I'm planning to be here. I don't care if they have to bring me in a box. I'm coming. So I wish you well with that. And thanks for a good conference. It's been really good. It's good energy. It's moved well. And there's been groceries everywhere you look. And mostly Roop eating them. But I was hoping to get some. He invited me to dinner and left. What a sweetheart. And that's our old wise leader. But it is great to be here. And I want to tell you what we do. Yeah, I'll share my story. I can't say it all, but I'll share as much as I can. And in a way, I think I'm the most fortunate guy on the planet. And I hope you feel that way too, but I genuinely feel that way. I'm the most fortunate guy I know. Because I stumbled into this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous and have found a way of life that I couldn't have imagined in my wildest imagination, my drunkest days or whatever. I couldn't have imagined. It's just been an absolute hoot, and it's just started. I tell you, I can't wait for the second half. We're going to get her going. Somebody called me the other day, asked me about coming somewhere way off sometime, 2 or 3 years from now. And I said, you do know who you're talking to, don't you? Yeah, I said, you know how old I am? And he said, we don't even want to know. We're dragging you anyway. So I am delighted to be here. It is good to be with you. It's like home, folks, here. George is not a stranger to me. And so I'm always glad to be back. So let me tell you about this guy, what started the deal. I walked into my first AA meeting at 1 o'clock in the afternoon on Saturday, the 2nd of February, 1957. And honest to God, I don't think I've ever felt more out of place anywhere in my life than I did in that first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, granted, this was a long time ago, not quite as long as Bill, but it's used to be a lot longer, but Bill keeps having more and more sobriety, and mine shrink somehow. I don't know how he pulls that off. But I used to be the last dude standing. That's Bill. And it's so funny. But when I walked in, I truly did. I never had felt more out of place. I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. Now, I had plenty of evidence that would indicate otherwise, but I didn't really believe I was an alcoholic. I never had any other diagnosis in my life except ugly. And that one got hung on me a lot, but it didn't mean anything. Didn't know what it meant. It didn't mean a thing to me. So when I walked into that room, I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I was the youngest guy in the room for a lot of years. I don't know how it was back in the First World War when you came in, but when I came in, yeah, I was the youngest guy everywhere I went. And I'm telling you, I got so tired of people patting me on the head and telling me how lucky I was. I didn't feel real lucky to be at Alcoholics Anonymous 24 years old. Man, I thought I was in a wake or something. What was my wake? And it really was. Just felt totally out of place. Didn't identify with anybody in there. Now, my first meeting, you know, I'd like to say I'm no stranger to Georgia. Most people here, if I fall out, there are a number of people here who could just pick it up and say, now, here's what he would have said. So when I walked in there and it felt so totally out of place, yeah, I didn't leave. But I had a lot of fears. You know, I had a lot of fears, a lot of barriers to my getting started. You know, I was a guy that grew up, I know this didn't reach Georgia, but I grew up in the old Bible Belt days during the Depression in western South Carolina, uncomfortably close to Georgia, really close. And they looked a lot alike, and I started picking cotton before I went to school. And I knew right away that was not going to be my trade of choice. Before I even knew what a trade was, I knew that wasn't it. And so that's where I grew up during that depression. And it was pretty lousy bringing. I got introduced to Bible Belt religion. And there are some people that, I mean, there's wonderful people in that field. But there were people who would make it a habit to just make a route. They would run a route and go into those things and bunch up the farmers in a tent or a barn or anything and have at them pretty hard and then leave with the money. Pretty good deal, yeah, particularly during the Depression. And so I grew up in that. I grew up in a church that I never found to be a warm and welcoming place. Now, I'm sure that they what they were doing, they considered to be warm and welcoming, but it didn't seem that way to me. When I went in there, I always was drugged by my mother. I don't think I ever voluntarily went, but she drugged me anyway. And I couldn't figure out what the folks were doing. I mean, as a preschool youngster, I mean, that was highly confused. I'd see people leaping up in the air and jumping around and yelling and beating drums and shaking snakes and stuff. That made no sense to me. And rather than seeing something that looked warm and welcoming, that was scary. That was scary. And so I swore if I ever got big enough that I could get my hand out of Mama's hand, I wouldn't be going back there. And that was not just an idle comment by a child. I never went into a church until I was sober 11 years at AA. And so I meant that. Yeah, I was absolutely burned deeply with the whole idea of religion. I know that was a grotesque exhibition of it, at least I think it was, but it certainly wasn't something that I aspired to get any piece of. And so that was just one of a number of things that kind of set me up to have a lot of difficulties. And so when I walked into that meeting, I knew it was going to be a religious hootenanny of some sort. The only guy spoke to me, many of you know, I was in finishing school at the time. When I went to that first meeting, it was a school for the finished. It wasn't for finishing. I was in a maximum custody penitentiary for a crime that I had absolutely no recollection of committing then or now or ever. But a horrible crime. It happens all too often to alcoholics. And it's every day in this country, every day in Atlanta, Georgia, I guarantee it happens, that some crazy drunk like me driving down the road and just wantonly in somebody's life. And that's what happened. Yeah, I didn't even know. I never did know till I went to trial what had really happened, till I heard somebody reported and testify in the court that I was driving blind drunk down the main street of the city and struck and killed two people whose only crime was trying to cross the street where I was trying to drive. And so not only the thing of feeling out of place, I felt enormously guilty to even be walking into something that was clean and decent and where people had a purpose. And I felt like I was just absolutely a contradiction of what that was all about. So there were a lot of barriers, a lot of fear, of ignorance, of guilt, of shame, and on. So I don't think I would have been a real red-hot prospect from all standards. But I walked in that day, stayed, and listened to the first AA speaker I ever heard. And he was a fine man. He became my first sponsor, but not that day. And he came in and told his story. And he did what alcoholics do, just like I'm going to do. He started told his story. And I couldn't figure out why he was doing that. I mean, why in the world? He wasn't a bad-looking guy if you didn't get close to him. But he was a guy. He'd been a professional boxer and apparently a poor one because he was a whacked-up guy. And so he'd come in from Detroit with that blue preaching suit like my buddy has. He had that thing on. And, oh, bless your heart. I knew there was one humanitarian in here. Bless your heart. Thank you. My host is supposed to do that. So welcome to AA, Jeremy. But I mean, you see just from that little scenario that this was not going to be likely the member of the year. This was not somebody who's going to have much of a prospect in Alcoholics Anonymous. But when I listened to that guy tell his story, I didn't identify with it. I mean, nothing he said. Yeah, I tried to box one time myself, and I was worse than him. I tell you what, it didn't take me long to figure out that was not my calling. I thought it was just Saturday night, good time at the bar. Those folks are serious about that, man. They get out and run up and down roads and climb mountains and what, just so they could try to knock me out. And I said, shoot, this is enough of that. So I identified a tiny bit with him. And I left more confused than I was when I came in. And miracle of miracles, the next week I was back. Nobody sent for me. Nobody would have missed me if I wasn't there. There are 300 members in that group. They wouldn't have known I was there. It was about the size of this conference. In the neighborhood. But left totally confused, had no clue, couldn't spell AA, had no idea what it was about. So here I came back. Couldn't have told anybody why I was back. Nobody cared. You know, I'm just another face in the crowd. And what brought me back, I've shown off enough. Now, I've got to get out of this dude. It's a handsome coat, but it's gone. I'm even going to loosen the rope. Is that sacrilegious, Bill? Go on, sac. Whoa. Thank you. Now I can breathe again. But I came back. What brought me back to my second meeting was not identification. You know, that's the heart and soul of what makes AA connect. But it wasn't identification. I didn't identify with anything about that man. What I did respond to was he was without question the most enthusiastic man I had ever met in my life. Now, I didn't have that conclusion that day. I just knew that for some reason I'm going back to something I don't even understand what it is. But it was that magnetic, the people that have that kind of enthusiasm, they draw people. I mean, you want to be around people who've got energy and positive vibes and you cherish time with. There are people who can walk in a room and they don't have to do a thing. The room changes when they walk in. It's just people who've got that special spirit, and God, how valuable it is. That's what brought me back to my second meeting of AA. Couldn't have explained it, didn't have to. But I just sat there. I stayed in that place 3.5 years, never missed a single meeting. Not because I fell in love with it. Truly didn't believe I was alcoholic. But there was plenty of evidence. Now, I'd had a trail of people who had total conviction that I was alcoholic. Yeah, a lot of people had. I was booted out of the military with an undesirable discharge for alcoholism when I'm 20 years old. You know, and that discharge paper was the kind of stuff you really want to post on your wall. It says, undesirable discharge, unfit for military service, -alcoholism. And I'm 20 years old. That didn't mean a thing. It meant one thing to me. One of our great leaders said, free at last, thank God Almighty, I'm free at last. That's what that meant to me. Man, I had liked that thing for about 30 minutes when I first went in, and I got over it very quickly. I mean, none of it made sense. You know, walking around 110 degrees with an iron hat on your head made absolutely no sense, none. You know, walk everywhere you go. They got 10,000 vehicles lined up. They don't ever move. I mean, they just stay there, lined up, don't dare get out of place, wash them every day. And here are the poor old soldiers laying down their life for the country, walking, knee-deep in sand. Now, it didn't make sense. And so I didn't like it. I quit. I did a rude awakening. You don't quit till they quit, you know. So they came, got me, locked me up. I thought, that's no way to run an army. And so I did it again. Every time I'd run off, they'd come get me and lock me up. And finished training down at Fort Jackson in South Carolina. Finished training. And it just to honor you, they put you out on a hot asphalt field in 110 degree weather and listen to somebody talk half a day about what wonderful people we are. And we just died. It was melting enough too. And in the court, 1,000 guys were finishing that thing, lined up out there. They picked out the 5 outstanding soldiers out of that 1,000 and were going to offer them the opportunity to go into leadership training and then into OCS and become an officer. And so they called off the 5 guys. I was one of them. That's still the most ludicrous thing I have ever heard of in my life. Well, you talk about military evaluations. Come on. And that's, when they said that, I said, huh? People around me said the same thing. Everybody knew about me, but the bosses, you know, so they sent me off leadership training. By the time I got up there, they found out what they had, changed their minds, and they stationed me in an exotic state, the now state wasn't in, Alaska. Marvelous, yeah. Stayed there a year in a little old place, a goofy place. I don't know why we were there. Just to unload a boat every once in a while. And anyway, there it was. All it was just an old place between mountains and glaciers, and they had a few buildings, had one vehicle that hauled people. That belonged to the post commander. He was the only one. There was nowhere to go. All the road did is go right around those buildings. I mean, you get out there like a kid riding a go-kart or something. And, I don't know what happened. I wasn't mentally there when it happened. But I woke up in jail as usual. And the guys told me, I knew them, I was a regular customer. They told me, said, man, you won't believe where we got you last night. I said, where? And they had been, the way they told it, they'd been making their rounds, you know, you could walk. You didn't have to car. You could walk. They're making their rounds. They came to this big snowbank, and there was vapor coming out of the snowbank. And they said, there are no hot ponds up here. What's that vapor? So they dug in. There was Barney Oldfield sitting in the commander's car, far as I could get. So I guess I'm there waiting for the snow to melt or something. But anyway, they of course hauled me out. You know that, and then that got me promoted to ADAC. Where's that woman from ADAC that's here? Now here's a brave woman. She grew up on the place I'm talking about. They now call it Rat Island. Did you know that? It has been promoted. It's no longer ADAC. It's Rat Island. They just got shipping out 500,000 rats off of that island. They replaced me. She grew up there. Watch her. If you grew up there, man, you're either tough or, well, be careful. Oh, my God. And that's what I was. I'm up there, the young hero, guarding a stupid rock. And that's what it is. It's a rock in the middle of the Bering, not in the middle, just in the Bering Sea. That's a very cold body of water. If you fall in it, you got 5 minutes. That's it. Ain't nobody live there but seals and walrus and other kind of goofy things. Nobody for these is getting in there. And that's where I was. Had a gun supposed to shoot somebody, never knew who. And we weren't fighting anybody. They were going to shoot a seal like that. Anyway, that made no sense. Now, I solved that like every problem I ever had. I drank like a fish. They gave free booze just so you didn't go crazy. It worked. We shipped a whole boatload of people, the purists, you know, who didn't drink. They'd get out and jog up and down the rock, you know. Well, that looks goofy. An ADAC, I mean, it just looks goofy to me. Nobody does that unless some of the bears chasing them or something. But they went goofy. And they loaded them on the boat, shipped them out. The drunks were laying there fat and happy and didn't know if we were in ADAC or Hawaii. Didn't matter, you know. But that's where it was. And so I had a marvelous career. And that's where I developed alcoholism. Now, I certainly didn't know it at the time. But I'm an old-fashioned type of guy. I believe. You used to hear it said all the time about crossing a line. You know, that's not scientifically demonstrated anywhere. But refer to developing alcoholism as crossing a line from whatever kind of drinking, social, wild, recreational, or whatever, into uncontrolled drinking or alcoholism. Hindsight tells me that happened with me when I was about 18 years old. I went in at 16. I had been 16, 19 days when I went in the military. So I'd up to about 18 when I got out on ADAC. And looking back, I could see where the character of, not probably not the amount, but the character of my drinking, that if I took a drink, I could not predict what I would do. And that was just, I mean, I was pretty wild and crazy anyway. But if I'm just going to have a drink with somebody, that was the start of something that wouldn't stop until I either hit the wall or ran out, one or the other. I never stopped because I had enough, didn't know what that felt like. And so that's what I did. And they messed with me as long as they were willing and then shipped me back to the States. And I understood that they'd had enough. Now, do you thank God, I mean, not me. I didn't want to be salvaged and become a soldier. I went out of there. And today, thank God, we have resources to to try to work with GIs who get in trouble with that kind of thing. Sorry about that. Barking. It's your water. But it's good, though, I tell you that. Yeah, great, thanks. Yeah, and so, but back then they didn't. And what they do, just put up with a guy like me as long as they could, and then they tell. And so I knew it was coming. I got moved, booted back to Kansas, Fort Riley, Kansas. And one day I got the word that they were getting ready to boot me out. So on the 27th of December, 1951, in order to demonstrate that they were making a horrible mistake, I wasn't arguing, but I wanted to demonstrate that I wasn't really an alcoholic. I was just misdiagnosed. And so I demonstrated that by going down to the town at Junction City, Kansas, and spent the night on the floor of the city jail in Junction City, Kansas, uncomfortably close to the John. And some of those crude jokers, I think, had very poor aim. Because I tell you, I was one sad-looking thing when I came to the next morning. And some nice, crisp young soldiers came out and they loaded me up, took me in. I knew it was a one-way trip. Went in, met with four officers. They were sitting there, starched and solid and good, solid people. And I met with them, and they went over a little bit of the history and said, we'd like to help you. We've tried, but you just don't seem to want to work with it. So we have to let you go. And that's when I got that piece of paper, undesirable discharge, unfit for military service, alcoholism. 20, had just turned 20. And so I didn't have any real feeling of failure or anything like that. I genuinely was just glad to be free. I was the kind of guy who never did. I didn't have a plan and lose it. I was the kind of guy who never had any plan for life. Never had goals or objectives or things I wanted to do or careers I wanted to develop. Those were foreign language to me. I was just a guy going from one event to another. And there was no real rhyme or reason to it. It was just a matter of how things fell. And so that was the same way when I hit the streets, doing the same thing there. Went to work in Charlotte, North Carolina. And the first year I was there, I got a job selling a soft drink that had just come on the market. Nobody would buy it. You had to sell that stuff. I mean, you really had to sell it because nobody going to come knocking on your door. I won Salesman of the Year for that company. First year. And fired the same year. Is that the story of an alcoholic? You're either a world beater or a bum. I mean, there is no middle ground. There's no mediocre. You know? And so that was it. And then I'll just kind of capsule this in a way that, I love drunk-a-logs. You believe me, I love drunk-a-logs, especially mine. I could just listen to that thing all night long. And I don't apologize for it either because I think the finest type of AA meeting in the world is what we're doing here tonight, an open speaker meeting. Not heavyweight discussion, an open speaker meeting. Because if you go back, I won't dwell on it, but I'll just tell you real quickly where that comes from with me. If you look at Bob's story, where he's describing about how he met Bill and they had that meeting at the gatehouse at the Cyberling Estate, and what happened that day forged the basic tenet of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so when Bob wrote his, if you want to look at that, it's the facing page of the end of his story, the facing page. And what he's doing is describing that in a little short paragraph. And he basically said so many words. He posed the question himself. He said, what was it about this man, Bill Wilson, that was different than all the other people with whom I'd spoken. Now, he was a professional man. He was a doctor. He was a scientist. He was a guy that was well-read, highly educated, very, very intellectual man. And here is a stock hustler from New York sitting down and had an experience with him that transformed his life and continued to transform Bill's. And what Bill did, and Bob, when he answered his question, what was it about this man that was different? And then he answered, he said, it was because he talked with me of his own experience. Not theories or abstracts or treatises on it or that. It was about he told his story. And he identified. And what we set up was not agreement with our, that we have commonality. What we set up in this fellowship is identification. Most important thing, and that's why I think the open speaker meeting is so important. Because some guy like me is going to get up here and tell my story. Everybody won't identify with it, but I better guarantee you some will. And some will identify with pieces of it. But that's what it's for. And it did form the basic thing. This is not about agreement and educating each other and all this kind of stuff. It's about identification. That's why I don't get off into it, but I'll just allude to it. That's why singleness of purpose is extremely vital. Because if we don't provide for alcoholics what we say we do, what we're doing is abdicating responsibility. We say this is a place where you'll find people like you that identify with you. We've got an obligation, a holy obligation, to deliver that. So when somebody comes in and it sounds like Noah's Ark, that's not quite carrying out the mission. So that's what happened with him. And that thing of identification. Now, I had never really gotten to that point of, you know, of identifying or thinking I was alcoholic or anything like that. But I was just a guy that when I went through those things, I had just pretty well given up on any notion of life. Never had much, but I didn't have any much notion of life. And so I had bummed around, just went from one thing. Every time I'd hit the wall, what I'd do would just push it up and start over again. What I failed to see was every time I'd hit the wall and hit the ground, and I started over, I would ratchet down and down till I was living a kind of life that I didn't even know existed. Now, I grew up in rough country here in the Depression in South Carolina. Was bad enough, and I hung out in the joints at our pleasant little nightclubs that we call, what do we call those things? Roadhouses or those beer joints that strung up and down highways, and they were, well, anyway, they were not exactly culture clubs, I'll put it that way, and so, but I grew up in that, but I never really thought seriously about having a problem, and so What I did is I just bounced that. I'd hit that wall and start over, hit the wall. What I didn't notice is that I would ratchet down until I wound up living a kind of white life that I really didn't even know existed. Now, I had lived, and when I was around those joints, I mean, that wasn't really real nice places, but when I moved, when I started bopping around, I wound up in the city of Flint, Michigan. And I won't even ask her to identify for herself, but there's a woman in this audience. I will not tip her hand for Flint, Michigan. She didn't pledge me to not tell it. But if it gets told, she's going to tell it. I am not telling it whatsoever. I might allude to it. If you get me privately, I might point her out now. You know, I might rat her off a little bit. But that's something. You talk about tough on ADAC, try Flint. That's where I wound up. I had no goal in mind. I just happened to go there. They were loading up a bunch of, anybody had enough sense to get on the bus, they'd load them up and go. And so I wound up in Flint, Michigan. Worked in General Motors till they found out what they'd hired. And then they decided to cut my career short. And that was a short career. I got blackballed in every General Motors plant in the world. And that's what Flint was. So that's what I did. So I just started drifting down. And working on day labor and painting and anything. I started a tree cutting business one time. It looked simple. I mean, you know, these guys go in there, cut down a tree, and what, take the money, go. Well, I said, that's a no-brainer. Man, I cut down a tree. Well, they build houses about 2 feet apart up there. They don't have ground. They just build houses. Well, I thought, good God, all I got to do is aim it. And so, well, a little more skill to it than that. My career lasted one tree. And And I dropped that sucker and left. I guarantee you, I went out of business in a hurry. But anyway, I just sort of experimented with the food chain and wound up there. Wound up unemployed. I'm not a criminal. I'm an alcoholic. I'm not a criminal. I have never deliberately committed a crime in my life. I'm not a thief. I didn't steal, drunk or sober. Now, if you left your drink unattended, I might help you with that, but that's not stealing. That's just a little bit of social interchange that goes on. But I do that. But I'm not a thief. But when you're living in an environment like that, you do what's done in that environment. And so I wound up living in Flint, Michigan, by the way, was twice voted the worst city in the United States in which to live. I don't know how you get into running for that, but when they voted it for that, I felt proud. I thought, man, shoot, I helped put them on the map, man. I did my part. And so, but in that, I lived in the worst section of the worst city in the United States of America. And I guarantee you that was not the social interchange there. You can believe that. That was just a predatory jungle. And it was only two types of job categories there. There was either the rollie or the roller. And whichever was friskiest on a given day would be the E, the other would be the er. And so, anyway, I wound up doing that. Yeah, I wasn't reared to do that stuff. You know, I mean, we might poke you a little on Saturday night and in a dance or something, but I mean, that's not like. So anyway, that's what I wound up doing. And selling my blood, $5 a throw. I don't even know what it goes for now, but it's certainly probably more than $5. But anyway, that's what I did. I would let them pump me dry, you know, had they not had controls on that kind of stuff. And so that's who I was. I wasn't a guy that was just a nice young fraternity fellow who got into a little bit of too much stuff and wound up in a tragic accident. That's not. Yeah, I was a guy that was just a social wrecking ball. And an idiot could have diagnosed me and marked my trail of what was going to happen. I didn't. I'm just blundering through life. And so then the unthinkable happened. I knew I was capable of anything, but I never really believed I would ever do anything that couldn't be undone. And I came to a jail, my regular jail there in Flint. I knew everybody worked there. Most people locked up. So I went in, and that was no news. I came to the next morning, assumed I was in there for the same as always. You know, just drunk or hustling or scuffling on the street or that kind of stuff. You know. And after I was awake a little while, I knew the routine. The jailer came by just like he always did. Wanted to see if anybody wanted to try to make bond or get out or whatever. And so I went up to the bars. I said, "Hey, guy, when can I get out?" And he just looked at me with utter scorn and said, "I hope never." Walked off. I had no clue. Excuse me. I had no clue what he was talking about. But I knew he was serious. I mean, there was no playing. And so I went back into the tank, and one of the guys that I didn't know, he came over and he said, "Man, you know what you're in here for?" I said, "No." "Do you?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "Last night some guy was driving drunk up to Main Street and struck and killed two people, and they've arrested you for the crime." And had absolutely no knowledge of that, not whatsoever. You know, blackouts are a hell of a thing. They're very real. And when I was greeted with that information, you know, it wasn't necessarily that part of the blackout is long over. But the mind won't take in what it can't handle. And when I was greeted with that information, I just simply couldn't handle it. And so I just refused to believe it and gradually accepted what appeared to be true, that I'd done more damage than any alcoholic ever ought to be allowed to do. First time I'd ever been in jail, I didn't try to get out. I didn't want to get out. I was ashamed to get out. All I wanted to do was disappear. I didn't have any desires or fears or anything else. I just wanted to be gone. And somebody, I'll never know because I'm not going to try to find out, but one of the policemen there at Flint apparently saw the condition I was in, and he had the records there at the jail, so they learned I had family in North Carolina, called my folks, and my mother and sister were my family at that point. Called them and said, "You got a guy up here in a lot of trouble, and if you want to try to do anything for him, you better come on." Well, I mean, I could never explain the behavior of families of alcoholics. There are people in this room who are expert on it. You understand it? Because I truly believe that the illness of alcoholism is more punitive to the family of the of the alcoholic than it is to the alcoholic. Because they have to deal with it clear-minded. They have to try to explain unexplainable behavior. They have to pretend everything's okay when their whole life's falling apart. So, I think it's a tough, tough thing. My family did exactly what alcoholic families tend to do. Made no sense. It wasn't the first time somebody called them from some jail and said, "We got your guy up here." But thank God it's been the last one so far. But they called. Family went up there, went in, did what families do. They made a trip from North Carolina to Michigan, which is no gimme. Even with cheap gas, that's a long trip when you're working in a cotton mill. So they came up, got an attorney that they couldn't afford to try to get a guy dealt with that didn't even want to be dealt with. I just wanted to disappear, to be gone. But I didn't know how to say that to anybody. So they got a lawyer. They got me released on bond. I knew I would not drink. I knew drinking was a big deal in my life. I truly didn't believe I was alcoholic. My commitment to not drink didn't have anything to do with inability to drink. It was just the overwhelming guilt of how could you possibly drink after having done something like that drunk? That's perfectly logical. If you understand alcoholism, it's the exact reverse. How would you not drink after something? But I didn't know that. All I know is I got out on the 17th of July of 56. I didn't make any deathbed promises or anything like that, but I knew I wouldn't drink. I didn't know what to do. I walked the streets. I didn't want to be around anybody. I was ashamed to be breathing, for God's sakes. Never mind visiting with anybody. And so that's what I did till about noon on the 18th the next day. Then I started to drink, of course. And from the 18th of July to the 19th of November, I literally drank like nobody I've ever seen. And that's not an idle statement. In an earlier session, I was talking about the 12-step works and how vital it was in our fellowship. I came in the heyday of 12-step work. And so I've worked with thousands of hands-on. I'd never seen one like me. Everyone I ever worked with was fighting it or protesting or something. And I just gave up. I just flat gave up. I think I was very deliberately, diabolically trying to drink myself to death. And I guess I figured that if I left a question mark instead of a conclusion, that my family would say, "Well, it must have been an accident or something." If they'd find me dead in an alley, it wouldn't have the same look as. But anyway, that's what I did. And then on the 19th of November, I was to be tried for manslaughter, and I knew that there was no trial. I mean, I couldn't even test. They put me on the stand, but I couldn't even testify at my own trial. The hell of blackouts. You know, what are you going to testify to? And so they'd ask me a question. I'd say, "I'm sorry, I don't know. I'm sorry, I don't know." And that was it. And I listened to the testimony, and my vote would have been exactly what the vote of the jury was. This guy's guilty. And so I had absolutely no qualms about it. I had no argument with it. And I was sentenced that day to a sentence of 5 to 15 years. In the Michigan State Penitentiary. Now, you gathered that I was not a hothouse flower, but I was not a criminal. I was not somebody. I'd never even seen a prison to know what I was looking at. But I was always locked up in that sort of entry-level sort of social nuisance stuff. Overnights in a jail or a county jail or a P-farm or stockade in the military. It was always stuff like that. I'd never been into a serious crime of any sort. And so when they passed that sentence, I guess it's understandable. I had an instinctive reaction of fear, just a normal human reaction of fear. But almost the same time, the most real sense of relief I'd ever known, because I knew it was over. It was over. Now, I'm not talking about happy days ahead. I'm talking about it's done. It is flat done. And I knew when I walked out of that place that I would never come back out of it. Didn't have any questions nor any concerns. I just wanted to disappear. Next day, they took me into the maximum custody penitentiary in Jackson, in Michigan, just out of Detroit and Flint, filled with people from Detroit and Flint. So it was not Disneyland either. It was not a nice place. The day that I was taken in there, I went through a gate, through a wall, walked in. The day I went in there, there were 6,300 and something guys locked up behind one wall, 40 feet tall. And I'm just one more fish in the pond, just one more tragic face in a sea of tragic faces. And I truly did not believe I would ever come out of there alive. Well, that's a predatory jungle. And I just knew I didn't, honest to God, didn't care. And it wasn't cynicism or anger or anything like that. It was just, I'm finished, I'm done. And so when I was checked in, I was almost a comatose guy. I was conscious of time and place. I knew where I was and knew the address and knew the names of people that told me their name. I wasn't out of it, but I was just disconnected from anything having to do with social interaction. And so they took me in. They started the process. A guy talked with me. Several did. I didn't have to make any conversations. If they asked me a question, I'd answer it. And that was the sum total of my conversation. And a guy talked with me one day. He was a nice guy, MSW. And he went over. He showed me my record. Now, and as I said, I've never committed a crime per se. Yet he had a record 3 inches thick. He held it up and he said, "Man, you've had a lot of trouble with booze." I said, "Yeah, my God, anybody." So he didn't tell me. Everything in that 3-inch record was drunk and fill in the blank. If you can do it drunk, blank. If you can do it drunk, I've done it drunk. Whatever it was, I've been arrested for it. That's what the whole record was. And so, I mean, we weren't having a conversation. He was just making an observation. Here's what your case shows. You've had a lot of trouble with booze. And then he said, "We have an AA group here, and I think you ought to go." Now, that was just like saying, "It's raining. Why don't you go inside?" You know, I mean, no drama, no nothing. You need to do this and all this kind of stuff. But we hadn't invented how to mechanize this process and then drive people and mandate them to the grave. We hadn't gotten that sophisticated yet. So he just said, "We have an AA group." I didn't know what he's talking about. He could have said a ballet chord. It would have meant just as much. And he said, "I think you ought to go." That's the end of the conversation. And a few days later, I got a little note from him that said, wasn't a, like, "Hello there, how are you?" note. It was a little note saying, I understood why later. He said, "You can go to your first AA meeting, 2nd of February, 57, 1 o'clock in the school." And I didn't want to go. I didn't even know what it was. Yeah, I mean, this was before AA became well known, you know, and best I can tell, there were 125,000 members when I came in. I became 125,001. So I'd never heard of that. They didn't ring any bells with me whatsoever. After that interview, just a few days later, I don't know how many, I had a note on my bed, the bunk in the cell. It said, "You can go to that meeting." I didn't know what all that meant, but when you got 6,300 and something guys, everything's crowded. I mean, everything's crowded. You had to have an open chair before you could get in, and so that's what that meant. And I didn't know that. I learned it. So that day, we have a lot of language in AA. I think the most beautiful word, the most powerful word in the language of recovery is surrender. Surrender. Not knowledge or will or determination. Surrender. It's about giving up at depth. And thank God that's where I was. You know, and when I got that little old note, I didn't even think about debate or argument. It was just like ringing the bell and Pavlov's dog jumps or something. So the day came, and they announced the AA group. And somebody told me, "That means if you want to go to the AA group, go over there." So I went. If I hadn't gone, nobody would have cared, including me. But I went over there. And just what I talked about at the beginning, they walked in. The only guy who spoke to me was an officer. And he said, "You have a seat." So I sat down. And that's what started in Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, you can see that I had a heavy agenda. I not only felt out of place and unworthy sitting in a group meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, given my history, I felt deeply ashamed to even be in a place where folks are talking about decency and trying to have a decent life and doing well. That was a language that was no longer a part of my vocabulary. So it was a number of factors that made it extremely unlikely that I would stick with that and do anything. But I kept going back. I never missed a single meeting. 3.5 years that I stayed in that facility and never missed a single meeting. And It wasn't because committed, yeah, but it was just that it was just automatic. Yeah, the group met, and I'd be there. Thank God what I went into was a fine group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, it wasn't a group of the year, but it was a fine group. And what I mean by that, it was a three-legacy group. We weren't just a bunch of drunks shooting a bull and swapping war stories. That wasn't that. We are a group of alcoholics in action. They were, and I became one of them. And so these guys did a great job of working with people. We had people in that facility. That's the recovery group. It'll always be my home group. I just don't want to be a member. Not at least not one in presence. I'll be a member in spirit, but I go back up there every once in a while to make sure I'm not there. And so I say hi to whoever took my place. I was so fortunate to go into that, to a group that was purposeful. The thing about a group, there's a sensitivity in a group that won't happen in just a casual gathering. You'll pick up on what somebody needs. Some people need a little boot in the butt. Others need a pat in the back. Some need a little encouragement. Some need a little bit of straight talk. It's just different, and a group will sense that. And for some reason, I don't know why, but they got their sights on me. At first, now nobody ever asked me if I wanted to get involved in service. I never heard the word for a long time. They used it in any connection to a person. Then the guys started saying, "Hey, Tom, go with us." I said, "Well, where are you going? Don't worry about it. Just come on." And so we did. It was an active group and did a lot of service work in a lot of days. I tell you what, I'm one of the best. The first thing I looked at when I got here was the chair setup. I talked to somebody that's on the committee. I said, "Now, that's a good setup. That's a speaker-friendly setup where you got it so you're surrounded the speaker. If you don't know how to do that, you put it church rows. You ain't talking to nobody." And so I appreciate that. And I'm good at it. I've been doing it for 54 years, for God's sake. I ought to be good at it or quit, one or the other. But that's how I got started. That was my first service. "Hey, Tom, help us with this. Help us with this table. Do this." Great stuff. And it was introductory. Best way to feel like you're on the team is get on the team. If people are working, you work with them. It's amazing how that works. The first thing you feel like you belong. You don't have to take an oath or anything else. Just sort of fall in and be one of the guys. A group that, I'll just tell you a little bit about that. Then I got a whole bunch of other stuff I'll tell you. I'm going to talk fast. It just won't sound like it. And they did an awfully good job. And one kind of defining thing to me, the guys did, and I became one of the guys that did it, but some of the older members would meet with the newer members coming in, and it wasn't like a beginner program taking through steps or anything like that. It was basically just an introductory deal. What does AA stand for? What's anonymous? What's an alcoholic? What's a sponsor? What's a home group? Just the language of the fellowship. And the guy was presenting that one day, and he had the shades hung up like we often do. And he pointed to the steps. He said, "There are 200 words in those 12 steps." I never have counted them to see if he's right. I don't want to ruin the trust. I'm going to trust him. And so he said, "There are 200 words. And if you will take the actions that are laid out in those steps as honestly as you know how to do, when you get through, you'll be a different cat. And it doesn't even matter what your motives are." I said to myself, "Come on, man, you can't throw a curveball." I know better than that. Conning is out. But the guy was right. There's a mythical notion. Bill can tell you because he's older than me by far. But there's a mythical notion that we used to do a much more refined job of taking people through the program. If they did, they sure hid it from me. But I never heard of anybody taking anybody through anything except a door. And foreign language. I never went to a big book meeting for the first 15 years I was in AA. Good reason, there weren't any. We were basically a run-and-shoot crowd. We were basically folks that did 12-step work. And that was powerful. But we do a 10 times better job of taking people, introducing them through the program now than we did back in those, quote, good old days. Because it was sort of just rock 'em sock 'em stuff. And that's what I did. I fumbled my way through those steps. And nobody worked with me. I didn't have a sponsor. the guy that spoke at my first meeting ultimately became my sponsor after about a year. There was one guy in the group that I felt close to. He was a good, solid, intelligent guy, and he and I would talk a little, but that's as close as it came to help. It was just conversation with two members. And when I got through with that, got through with that thing and did those steps, I was a different man, just exactly like that guy said. I had an absolute transformation as a result of the work of those steps in my life. Learned to live in a place that was just almost totally unconducive to life. And that's where I learned to live. That's the first place I ever experienced dignity, honor, integrity. That just simple things, eh? Good citizenship. I was a good citizen there. Lousy community. But I was a good citizen. And so, I learned those things. I'd never known them in my life. It came alive. And so I had an absolute transforming experience because those steps are powerful. If they'll do that in that jungle of a zoo, I guarantee you there's no place it won't do it. No place. And so, anyway, that started to work. And I became a free man, locked up as tight as a human could be, and became a free man. When I was in there, I'd been in there for a couple of years. I didn't get a call. I didn't have anything to call on, but somebody said, go to this office. Well, I went over there. Normally when you get summoned to the head office, it's not good news. They're not having a birthday party for you. It's normally bad news. And so I go over there with great fear and anxiety, walked in to the room, and it was the parole commission for the state of Michigan. I'd never met them. Nobody had in there. I mean, they didn't usually hang out there. So here they were. And the chairman of the commission, the board, came over, shook hands with me like it was a visiting dignitary. Shook hands and introduced himself. And I said, well, I'm Tom Officer. He said, yeah, I know that. Well, obviously, he had my whole life in front of him there. And we sat down. He said, you're probably wondering why you're here. I said, well, it had crossed my mind. I do wonder, why am I here? Because I wasn't nearly eligible. On a 15-year max, you had to serve at least one-fourth of the max before you could be even considered. So I was nowhere close to that. And so he said, about every 10,000 cases, we pick out a person, who seems to be an extraordinary example of restoration or rehabilitation. I forget which term he used. And he said, we've decided that we'd like to talk with you. I said, well, I certainly appreciate that. It's quite an honor. It really is. And so right off the bat, though, you guys had some real integrity. He said, I'll tell you up front now, we're not going to parole you at this point. The crime is too serious, and the time served is too short. And I told him genuinely, I said, I agree with you 100%. But I think you're exactly right. An offense like mine, and I know that there are people in this room who've had similar kinds of stuff. A crime like mine, you can't get any more serious, for God's sakes. Two people's lives ended. You can't get any more serious. But it's what's referred to in the legal world as a casual offense, simply meaning it was not an intentional act. It was something that just grew out of something else. And so he mentioned that as a casual offense. And normally they didn't put somebody with a casual offense in a maximum custody penitentiary. I was in the tightest lockup in the state of Michigan. And they normally didn't do that. They didn't normally put people there my age. But I think when they looked at my age, they made my history, they made an exception and said, we better keep this one because his history is, look out. And so they were wrong. They could have opened the door and I wouldn't have gone anywhere. But I think they had an inkling of that. So the guy told me, he said, well, this assures that when your eligibility day comes, you will leave the day you're eligible. I said, can't ask for more than that. And so when that day came, they told me I was going to have to go to North Carolina. And I'd been to the big city and seen the bright lights. I didn't want to go back to Podunk, the place up there. And I thought, could you just let me think it over? Right. I did. I said, show me the door, boss. And sure enough, the day came. Now, I was a good member of AA. I was a solid member of AA. I wasn't somebody that I was a wannabe. I was. And I already had my arrangements made in my town. I'd made contact with the only A's I could find. There weren't many around back then, Bill. You might remember that. It was a lonely place. And I wrote, and, first letter, that's been, 50 years ago. I haven't gotten an answer yet. Now, I think it's in the mail, but, no, my balloon was burst, as you could well imagine. And the guys told me, said, no, just because something causes itself an AA group doesn't mean it still meets. Some of them close up, some go away, some of them just quit answering the mail. And I said, well, that makes sense, So I wrote again to a smaller sounding little gaggle of folk, got a great answer back. Exactly what I'm asking. I wasn't asking, I didn't want a job or anything like that or a loan. All I want to know is it's okay if I come to the group. Got a great answer back. The guy that answered, he became my second sponsor when my first one died. And anyway, so I knew I was home. The day I walked out, I knew exactly what I was going to do. I know I've got many friends in here who do a lot of corrections work, and sometimes we get dismayed at the seemingly endless series of failures that we deal with. And I'm one of them. My God, I labor over why so many people go to the gate and drop like a rock. I just don't know, as much as I know about correction. It dismays me that. But I guarantee you, I was ready. I knew exactly what I was going to do. And I knew exactly where I was going. And when I had instruction to report to parole office as soon as you get off the bus, told me where it was. When I stepped off the bus, I violated parole. Because I didn't get over there and go to the parole office. I went to the telephone booth and called my AA contact. What I knew was that parole and rules and regulations would not keep me out of prison. I don't react well to rules. Even if I write the rules, I don't like them. I just rebel at rule stuff. And so I didn't do that. I went to the phone call, made a arrangement with the meeting that night. And so I was off and running. And so I went to work, and I'd love to tell you the rest of the story, but I can't. I'm not that cruel. I just tell you why I said early on. I think I am probably the most fortunate man I've ever met. I truly believe that, and I hope it's that way with you. But I, honest to God, believe that. I've had things in my life happen that defy imagination. I just want to tell you about some. And you hurry up and believe now. It's like I said, I wasn't some nice fraternity kid that had a tragic accident on the way to a party. That's not who I was. I'm exactly who I described to you. That's exactly who I am. And so my transformation was to a brand new life I didn't even know anything about. And when I hit the street, I was immediately active. Just a couple weeks after I was out, some guys that, word gets around in AA for an anonymous program. We got the darndest grapevine you have ever seen. I think everybody around there didn't even know me. He said, you here? I tell you one other thing. There's no extra charge. I tell you this. The night I got home, being well prepared is very important because drunks are just weird. And the night I got home, the word was out. And all my old bottle gang when I was down there all wanted to give me a homecoming. Well, you know how drunks want to give you a homecoming. So here they come with bags of hooch. And I met them. Said, yeah, come on in, guys. Come on in. Yeah, glad to see you. Good. I spent the night saying, nope, I'm not drinking. Oh, come on. I'm not you, man. You quit drinking? There ain't no way. So I listened to that all night long. About 4 o'clock in the morning, they start singing hymns. I don't know why drunks get spiritual, but they are singing hymns. And my poor mother's in there. Anyway, that was a welcome home. Suppose I hadn't been well prepared, eh? Suppose I hadn't been well prepared. Suppose I hadn't known what I was going to do. Suppose I hadn't had it lined up. I'd have been up for grabs. But instead, in fact, I got two of them in AA. One of them stayed sober. The other one didn't. Two of them. I spent that whole night watching them drink and listen to them try to sing. And the thing about it, people worry about getting rid of the old friend. You don't have to. If you're sober, they'll get rid of you. I mean, who wants to hang around some sober dude when they're drunk? So they got rid of me pretty quick. They're still my friends. Most of us are dead. No, I'm not yet, but most of the crowd are dead. And I got enormously active in AA. It's a good thing that I was well prepared. Because AA was the thing of the past in that town. The two people who led that burned in their own home. And so there was no There's no leadership. And leadership's vital. I mean, you have to have it. Just a nice bunch of good people doesn't make stuff happen. You got to have some leadership. So the leaders died. And that's what the problem was. And when I hit the street and I took a look at that desert, I said, man, alive, this is ridiculous. The meeting I went to on the street was the worst meeting I've ever seen. If we'd have had a meeting that bad in the penitentiary, somebody would have got hurt. I mean, we didn't have that kind of junk. And I sat there and just totally dismayed. I thought, my God, is this it? And I thought, well, I'm in this little old rinky-dink cotton mill town. Charlotte was 25 miles away, our biggest city. And I said, I'm going downtown where the action is. I'm not going to stay over here at this junk. But, you know, it's right at 164, as you're finishing up the text part of the book, it describes exactly what needs to happen, and that's what I did. So when you get to a new town, you know, you can't find where to go. It's not there. And that was the story back when the book was written. That was the story the day I walked out. And so when I walked in there, and I thought, man, I'm going to town. And then a disturbing thought hit me. Big boy, when do you become responsible? When do you step up to the plate? You know, I was almost the oldest guy in that area, in that immediate area. And I'm brand new. So they was in its infancy at that point. And so I thought, well, time's here, and it's time for me to go to work. So I went to work. It literally developing Alcoholics Anonymous in the city. Thank God for good preparation. Had a marvelous time, absolutely marvelous time. I'd love to tell you 103 stories about that, but I won't. I'm going to just punish you. Absolutely phenomenal experience. Got amazingly active, working in a prison thing. A guy came in. My parole supervisor came in one day back to my house just checking on me. And he's talking about, he said, Tom, you're really active in this AA thing. And I said, yeah. And he said, I thought he was going to say slow down. I knew I wouldn't. And he said, wouldn't it be helpful if you could drive? And I said, well, yes, sir, but I can't, as if he didn't know. And when I'd left Michigan, letters that big on the parole papers, this man's never operated a motor vehicle. I understood that, accepted that, and had no question. He did. And so he said, would it help? And I said, yeah. He said, let me check it out. And so normally that means goodbye. In his case, it didn't. And so a little later, a couple weeks later, he called me and said, could you meet me at the Sears store uptown? And I said, yeah. I got my sister to drive me up there, walked into the Sears store. My guy was standing back in the back of the store with a guy I didn't know. This really does sound like the Depression days. The driver's license counter was there. All it was a board. There was a guy standing behind it. And my guy was there talking to him, my pro guy. So he went up and he continued, and then I walked up and he introduced me to him. And the guy turned to me. And he called his name. He said, Mr. Logan says you might be interested in having your driver's license. And I said, well, yes, sir, that would be nice. But I knew that could not happen. Now, don't ask me to explain it. Because what I found out is that my boss does work different than most of us think. And he doesn't follow the same rule book either. And so I'm to never drive a motor vehicle. This guy, when he asked me about that and I said it would be helpful, he handed me a driver's license. Didn't even ask me if I knew how to drive. I mean nothing. No test of any kind whatsoever. None. Horn blowing or nothing. I mean, flat. Didn't even pay for it. That's not legal, is it? There's no way that's not legal. But I've been driving about 50-some years with amazing. You know, what I found, and I'll say it once, and it'll apply to two or three more things I'm going to tell you. What I found is when God has work for me to do, not when I want to do something, but when God has work for me to do, the walls come down. And I don't care what they are. They come down. If anybody told me that early on, I'd have said, yeah, right. If you know somebody. I didn't know anybody. I knew the sheriff from a professional standpoint. He'd locked me up many times. But that can't happen, but it did. And I went to prison the second week I was out. Some guys The word got around. They knew I was on the street. I just got out. They said, fresh meat. And so they came, said, go with us to jail, to prison. I said, have you lost your mind? I just got out, for God's sakes. I'm not going back in. They said, oh, come on, man. You've got something to offer. You'll get back out. We'll take care of it. Don't you worry. I said, I tell you what, I'm going to go, but you better hope I get out. Or if I don't, you better hope I never get out. Because, and so sure enough, I went in. 2 months after I was out of the outside sponsor. I'm on parole from a maximum custody institution, and I'm given the job to lead as a trusted servant in developing a program in that prison. What a tremendous, I couldn't have been more affirmed if I'd have been elected governor. Just absolutely unbelievable. Great experiences. I mean, just unbelievable number. I'll tell you about one other one that was just all shocking me. I was elected DCM. I was DCM when I was there 5 months. And one day I got a phone call from the headquarters of the state prison system. And so I got on the phone with a guy, and I knew he'd come by one time where I sponsored that group. And he'd come by, and I think somebody told him, go by and give this guy a pat on the back. He's trying hard, something like that. So he'd come by and just made a sort of how-do-you-do visit. And we chatted just for a couple minutes. And it was him on the phone. And I recognized his name, and he said, Mr. Ivester, we're expanding the rehabilitation program in our prison system, and we were wondering if you would consider accepting a position. Come on, I just got on the street, for God's sakes. I'm on parole from a maximum custody penitentiary. And I said, do you know who you're talking to? And he said, oh, yeah, we've checked you out. And of course, and I thought, good Lord. I did. To him, I said, when I got over to shock, I said, my God, man, I'd rather do that than anything I could imagine. To myself, I said, just what you'd expect, ain't no way. There had never been an ex-con in the history of this planet hired as a professional employee in a prison system. You guys in Georgia had one guy that became a county jail operation. It was the first one I ever heard of, that other than me. But I went to work. And I tell you this. It's a weird place to be. I had lunch one day with a fellow who walked on the moon. And I was fascinated by his story when he's telling me about what it felt like to step in where man had never stepped. And how that felt to him and how they went. And, you know, that's exactly what I felt. That I'm stepping where man had never stood. I'm going to some place where a guy with my resume had never stood. And I thought, man, this can't be. This can't be. And I went to work. And I had as fine a career as a man could have. I finished 2 years from Michigan State while I was locked up. I was coming off speed. And I'm not a drug addict, but I sucked up an awful lot of speed. Because I like long parties, and that'll do it. But it'll also screw up your wiring. And so I couldn't sleep. And so while I couldn't sleep, I took 2 years from Michigan State University. They invented television while I was drunk. They had Howdy Doody and Michigan State coming in. And so I finished 2 years. I could read a man with speed. I could read a book overnight. I mean, I was a speed demon. And so I had a little start. But they didn't hire me because of my education. Nobody ever told me in my entire career why they hired me. Why were they willing to do something? Had I screwed that up? My state would have been the laughing stock of the world. I mean, they would have all been cast as total idiots. Why are you going to put an ex-con working there supervising stuff in a prison? That took some brave people. The amazing thing to this day is not one single person. Now, my state is not the cutting-edge state of the world. We're not the rocketing into the ninth dimension. But we're pretty good folks. And my state, in my entire career, not one single person ever discussed my history. Not one. I mean, it even asked me a curiosity type question. Sometimes I wondered if they knew about God. They had to know. My state had to negotiate with the state of Michigan to get them to agree to release me from parole so I can become a professional employee in North Carolina. Now, you figure how many odds you'd bet on that, yeah, but sure enough, it happened. And so that started a career. I'll just tell you this in a succinct kind of way, that I had a magnificent career. I truly did. And the thing, you take this to the bank, it sounds weird, but you can take it to the bank. From the day I started my first job in recovery until what I hope was my last one, I never applied for one single job. I mean, not one. Didn't even fill out an application. You know, I was recruited for every job I ever had. And it wasn't because I was some brilliant whiz kid. They watched what I did and liked it, I guess. And I hired hundreds and hundreds of people. That's what I looked for. Guarantee you, I'm not looking for somebody who's disgruntled and mad at their boss. You can bet they won't be walking in my door. Because that's what I'll be the next one that's catching that, you know. So anyway, I gave every job I had my very best. And no matter what it was. And because my work tells you who I am. If I do sloppy work, that's who I am. And so my work is autographed that way. And so I kept getting drafted, invited in to successive roles. I became a supervisor, then a director of some programs. And then one day the boss called me and asked me to come by the office. And I went by and he asked me if I'd take over a prisoner's warden. And I mean, even though I'm in the system, it's one thing to be in mud wrestling with the guys, you know, and all that kind of stuff. It's quite another when you're the man. I mean, legally, I couldn't even possess a gun. Now I'm going to be in charge of all of them. You know? That's unreal. but it did. And so, anyway, it was that kind of just career that just unbelievable. But just what I said in the beginning, you know, if you don't believe miracles happen here, just keep your eyes open, take a watch. Because that what is it? That's why I believe I'm the most, not just because I had a wonderful career, but I'm a guy who was as isolated as anybody I've ever known. Today, there's not a state in the United States that I haven't visited and AA'd in. Not a one. Good number of foreign countries. I know of very few places that I can go. And if I don't get in touch with somebody, I guarantee you they'll be on my case because I'm there without their adult supervision or whatever they're trying to give me. But anyway, if you doubt that miracles happen, you just heard one. That cannot happen, but it did. It did. And all I did was give a broken and wasted life to this simple program and to give it my best shot. And it's taken me places I wouldn't have even knocked on the door. Amazing stuff. Found me a little girl in Saskatchewan, Canada. Married her. We'll be celebrating 43 years this year. 43 years. Unbelievable. Truly unbelievable. And she's a strong Al-Anon gal. She's been in Al-Anon most of that 40-something years, 41 or two. So it's something else. Anyway, I could go on forever and almost have, but I just tell you this, that I'm delighted to be with you. And if you're somebody, I know that everybody doesn't come here on a roll. You know, folks don't come here because they're just everything's going my way. I know there are folks here that are wondering about the next day. I hope that what you hear, I heard this fantastically lucky fella who's, his pedigree showed up and, no. What you hear is what God can do with human wreckage when I just turn it over. So what you're sitting in is a place where hope genuinely lives. And if you're wondering if there's hope, just look around. Because I guarantee you it is. And I sure, wherever you are in that recovery, I wish you well. And nothing but the very best. Thanks. Thank you a lot.